Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Bonnie, and I'll be your speaker tonight. Tonight, the talk is titled, Meditation is Boring. So there are different types of practices people refer to as meditation. In some traditions, there's guided meditation with someone speaking to you the whole time. There can be visualization, body scans, or meditation with music. But in Zen, we practice a particular type of meditation called shikantaza, which means just sitting. You sit with a straight back and breathe, and that's it. I remember the first meditation instructions I got, which was to sit down and shut up. And that was all the instruction I had for many years. So you could say, Zen meditation is the most boring meditation of all possible meditations. It's completely silent and still, not a lot of bells and whistles. There was one time when people mentioned to Les, our abbot, that meditation is boring. And Les answered, yes, meditation is boring. That is its most important quality. Often in our mainstream culture, we value activity over inactivity. We value speed over slowness, light over dark, positive over negative, masculine over feminine, strength over sensitivity, and exciting over boring. We push ourselves very hard, and the result is that we have a very unbalanced society where people are stressed out a lot. According to my friend Google, 55% of Americans are stressed out during the day. 46% experience a mental illness during their lifetime. 1/6 of American adults take a psychiatric drug, such as antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication. And 10% or 23 million Americans have a drug or alcohol disorder at some point in their lifetime. These are from articles that were pre-COVID prior to this year. And according to an article published by the Kaiser Family Foundation in August 2020, 53% of adults in the United States reported that their mental health has been negatively impacted due to worry and stress over the coronavirus. That's not just the coronavirus, it's worry and stress over the coronavirus, which means that the current mental health statistics are even worse than mentioned in earlier years, and we have yet to see the full effects of the current situation on our mental health. If I think about what is the opposite of stress, I think of boredom. Now, some people might say peaceful, but there's not much difference between the two except in the interpretation. When I look for a time when I first felt thoroughly bored, I have to go back to my early childhood, even before kindergarten and through early grade school. My mom would drop me off at my great-grandma Lillian's house, and every time I went there, it was exactly the same. She kept the house very, very warm, so it made you feel cozy and kind of drowsy, and your jacket would just fall off. She would sit in the back room in her squishy chair with her feet up watching TV. Nick at Night, I Love Lucy reruns, Bewitched, sometimes Wheel of Fortune. The carpet was orange and nothing changed except for a slight variation in image and hum coming from her black and white television set. There was really nothing to do there. She had one set of wooden dominoes that she kept in a round cookie tin. And I would take out these wooden dominoes and I'd set them up one next to another in a long trail. Sometimes I did straight trails, but sometimes I would do loops and waves. And I made them curve. And after I'd meticulously placed every single domino about an inch apart from each other, I would gently tip the top of my finger on one at the end, and they would all collapse one by one and fall over until the whole trail lay flat. Then I would scoop them up into a pile and start over again. I must have created domino trails hundreds of times because there was nothing else to do. If you walked down the hallway into the kitchen, you'd find a green refrigerator on your left side. And if you opened the right door handle, there would always be a loaf of sun-made raisin bread. The bread was pre-sliced with swirls of cinnamon, and it was in a red plastic bag with a happy girl on the front. The girl had brown hair and a red bonnet, smiling as she picked raisins into a basket. To the right of the cinnamon raisin bread was a stack of Kraft Singles cheese. It didn't matter what day or what year you went to Great Grandma's house. The raisin bread was always there in the same place. And the Kraft Singles cheese always was right next to it. I hardly saw my great grandma get up. I suppose she must have occasionally walked to the bathroom and back, but for the most part, she just sat in her chair. She didn't really even talk. A couple times I found a little cardboard golden book in one of her rooms, and I tried to get her to read it to me. And she was not interested in reading, so she would take the golden book and just fling it across the room. And sometimes I'd bring the book to her just to see how far she would throw it. So she was pretty quiet and not much of a conversationalist. She was in her 80s and she just didn't really move from the chair. I didn't even know how she got groceries, and I honestly didn't even think about it. The refrigerator refilled itself with an endless supply of raisin bread and cheese as if by magic. And if you open the freezer, there would be always the same box of tall popsicles in a few different colors and flavors with some lame joke printed on the popsicle stick. And it was always like that every time. There's only so much you could do with raisin bread and cheese. I could pop the raisin bread into the toaster and have warm raisin bread with Kraft cheese on top, or I could eat them separate. Those were your choices. And eventually I wasn't too hungry, and so I was just kind of eating for something to do. This was in the early years before I had homework and really anything else to think about. I can't even say that I was trying to pass the time. I was just being there. So I would take a piece of Kraft Singles cheese back into Grandma's room and sit on the couch, and I'd pull off that transparent film. Then I had a square of light orange, rubbery-looking cheese, and I'd fold it in half. Then I had two rectangles of cheese. Then I'd fold the top rectangle. Then I had two smaller squares of cheese, and I would just keep folding rectangle, square, until the top of the cheese tower was the tiniest square I could make and I couldn't fold it anymore. And then I would eat it, just the top piece. And then I would keep folding the other pieces, and when they got too small to fold, I'd eat those pieces. And that's how I could stretch one piece of cheese for about 20 minutes. When I finished that, I could go back to the refrigerator to get another piece of cheese and to fold it. Or I could set up the dominoes again. It was always very boring. It was not like I had a lot of pent-up energy where I was really wanting to do something and frustrated that I couldn't. It wasn't like that. And I also wasn't particularly happy. You know, I wasn't excited or elated or anything either. There was just nothing to compare it to. I was just kind of calm and it felt normal. Sometimes I would lay down on the carpet and look at the ceiling and just stare at the ceiling. She had one of those old-fashioned ceilings that looks like it's made out of cottage cheese. Looks like someone just took a bucket and flung cottage cheese up there and it stuck and just kind of froze into this mass of cottage cheese. And then there'd be a few little gold sparkles. And it looked kind of nice, and you could just lay back and stare at it whenever you wanted to. Now you might say, that sounds really boring. And it was. It was incredibly boring. Reliably boring, even. But I relaxed into it. I relaxed into the monotony of it. The monotony of just being with great grandma and her curled bunched up hair and her fake clip-on earrings and her hands were always folded on her lap while she watched her TV, while I played with dominoes and ate tiny squares of Kraft singles cheese. I was just there. Ever since my first day of college, I can't say I've ever really gotten to be bored. Not really. If I get 5 minutes, 30 minutes, or 1 hour where I don't have anything really urgent to do, if everything could just wait for 1 hour, it feels like a total luxury. I went to a demanding university program, and my work life is pretty typical of Silicon Valley ever since then. And on top of that, there's always been some kind of family or social obligations that have to be taken care of ever since I reached adulthood. It seems like a never-ending stream of things that need attention. So my life now is like the home needs to be taken care of. The car needs to be taken care of. Relationships need to be taken care of. Food needs to be taken care of. You've got to get groceries, laundry, pay the bills, meet the next work deadline, meet the deadline after that, call the plumber, trim the trees, change the car oil, answer email, update your resume, vote in the elections, vacuum the floor, buy so-and-so a birthday present, clean the garage, cook dinner, eat, take your vitamins, don't get sick, schedule dentist, doctor, chiropractor appointments, get gas, check the mail, do the dishes, prepare for the next Canando board meeting this weekend, sign paperwork, pack moving boxes, unpack moving boxes, go to the DMV, wash the car, water the plants, answer email again, join work meetings, coordinate schedules, figure out how to politely decline invitations, sort papers and recycling, figure out what is and is not recyclable, file taxes, answer email again. And it's a never-ending stream of things that need to be done. About 5 years ago, during a particularly demanding and stressful time at work, I vividly remembered my great-grandma and the time I had at her house. How comforting and stable it was. I would step onto the porch and ring the doorbell. Even her doorbell took its time, playing an entire song rather than just a single chime. The doorbell wasn't in any hurry to finish ringing, and great-grandma was not in any hurry to answer it. From the time I stepped inside the door to the time I left, I was guaranteed that nothing eventful would happen. There was no sense of emergency, no concept of violence, anger, or injustice, no stress, no politics, or any of the problems that plague our society. For the few hours I was there, I would be sheltered from all suffering. I can still see Grandma in her chair with her feet up, TV in the corner, the stone dog with droopy eyes by the entryway. We called the stone dog Sam, and his face wore an expression of utter boredom. Nothing moved in her house. It was like a never-changing TV set. Looking back, I see great-grandma's house as the most reliable and consistent thing in my entire childhood. Quite different from my family at home and my experiences everywhere else. I don't think I've ever been as carefree as I was when I was with her. Today, to calm my mind, I have to make a conscious effort to slow down the stream of never-ending things to do. I have to set aside time to be still for a brief moment. And if I'm lucky, I might catch a glimpse of that evasive, luxurious boredom. Not in a bad way, not in a good way, but just things as they are. There's an ancient Chinese symbol, which I've known as yin yang. That's my Western pronunciation because I grew up in California where we butcher all kinds of pronunciations. It's actually probably pronounced yin yang as it's a Chinese symbol. And so the yin yang is a circle with a light side and a dark side connected together. And in some versions of the yin yang, the dark side has a light circle or dot in it. And the dark side has a light circle and the light side has a dark circle. And this symbol reminds me of a passage from the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and equality. In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. The yin yang is a symbol of harmony and balance with equal parts light and dark, equal value for activity and rest, equal value for excitement and boredom. I think in Silicon Valley and the modern world in general, we've gotten so busy that we don't allow ourselves to just be. In some religions, such as Judaism with the Ten Commandments, it was actually mandated to honor the Sabbath that every 7 days you are commanded to take a day to rest. It was a commandment that every 7 years you had to let the land rest so that it can replenish the nutrients of the soil. But in modern times, if there's a pause or a small gap in our schedules, our culture pushes for us to go and fill it. To showcase our resume and how productive we can be, without acknowledging the truth that without regular rest, we lose productivity. And when we rest, we are both more productive long-term and happy. As we rush to go, 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 on to the next thing, we lose something. The yin-yang model shows us that two seemingly opposing polarities are actually complementary forces, which are interconnected and interdependent with each other. If we choose to see only one side, then we have a lopsided and incomplete view of things. We often think about the merits of our deeds and our accomplishments. How often do we take the time to consider the merits of boredom? Or what a blessing we might be to others if we were simply in a calmer state of mind. To close, I'm gonna play the short little song that my great-grandma's doorbell used to sing whenever I showed up on her doorstep. I was surprised I could actually find it online. And I found it's a short melody called the Westminster Chime, which I didn't know until today. But as we listen to this, and actually as you listen to any piece of music, think about your favorite piece of music, we should remember that we would not have music if it wasn't for the pauses in between the notes. The phenomenon of music is different sounds dancing together with silence, one pitch ending and another picking up. The pause in between gives us time to feel the resonance of the last note and to prepare for the next. If there were no pauses or fluctuations in volume, it would basically sound like someone constantly screaming, which is perhaps why we like to listen to heavy metal bands when we're really angry. But if we want to be balanced, most healing and enjoyable music reflects a balanced state, allowing for both sound and silence in a rhythmic cadence. And if we want our lives to be balanced, we should honor the pauses in our lives, the quiet time in between activities. We should value the moment when we stop to look out the window and can see and hear the pitter-patter of rain on the window pane, or watch a leaf as it floats from the top of the tree to rest on the ground. Our life falls quickly too, like the leaf falling to the ground. And if we're too busy to notice, we might miss it. That was Grandma's Doorbell. And with that, thank you, everyone. We're now open for questions. Or comments, or you can tell me how completely boring that talk was, and I won't be offended. Yes, Aaron.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on it. It was amusing, your story about your great-grandmother. It sounded like she had the exact same house that my piano teacher had. So it was amusing, your story had a lot of parallels to the times I would have to sit and wait as my other sibling would practice piano in the other room, and all I also had was the dominoes and the orange carpet. and as you were recounting your story, I was just it was interesting to feel how how reminiscent, and I really miss those times of being and sitting there for half an hour every week in this old house with nothing to do.
Thank you for sharing, Aaron. Yeah, that's kind of one of the questions I was thinking for all of you. When was the time that you were really bored? And where as a kid, you're like, I'm bored. But as an adult, you're like, that was a good time. I miss that, So thank you. Diane. There you go.
I'm unmuted. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Diane.
I loved your... I remember going to my grandmother's, and I'd like to sit on a sofa or a chair backwards and then lie back so that my head was on the floor and I could see everything upside down. You brought up a lot of memories. So when you sit zazen, it must be hard when you describe all the things you have going on in your life and all the things you have to do and now moving and adding a new job and all of that. So how are you successful in getting back to that boring place or that quiet place without your mind just chattering and chattering at you?
Thank you. That's a good question. With Zazen, I'd say it's different every time. I mean, every time you're in a new place, a new time, and no two Zazen experiences are exactly identical. So sometimes your mind is going crazy. I got so much to do. And you sit with, I've got so much to do, but I'm here. And sometimes it's really peaceful and quiet. But, you know, one thing I've noticed that even taking a few breaths or stopping for a couple minutes kind of can reset things and put me in a calmer state of mind. Even if I have a long to-do list, somehow stepping out of it for a few minutes and then coming back to it, it doesn't seem so stressful. It doesn't seem as urgent or intense. So I actually do that a lot at work. It's actually wonderful working from home because I can do that. I can finish a task, and before I hop straight into the next task, I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to lay down, or I'm going to sit down and just breathe. I'm going to make a cup of tea and just enjoy silence and listen to the hum of the refrigerator for 5 minutes and look out the window, you know? And for me, taking those micro breaks actually not only makes me more productive, and it also makes me happier and have a less stressed out mind. So yeah, I think it's kind of like listening to your body. Like, I need a little break right now. I need a little quiet time. And I would try to do this when I had to work in an office as well. And it was hard, but I would search out, like look for meditation rooms or quiet corners, or go outside and sit under a tree. And I would, you know, sneak away for a few minutes to kind of reset myself. Because I know for myself, I'm actually someone who's quite sensitive to noise and busyness, and yet I'm working in that world all the time. So I have to find ways to find small moments of quiet that kind of keep my mind in a calm state.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Nick.
Bonnie, thank you so much for your talk. From the musician's point of view, I just would really love to validate what you said about the relationship of music and silence. And any piano student who comes to study with me, whether they're a beginning student or it's a new student in my university studio, one of the very first conversations I have with them is I ask them, which is more important, the written notes in a piece of music or the written rests in a piece of music? And it's a deliberate trick question that I kind of trap them in. And I would say 9 times out of 10, a student always tells me, oh, the notes are more important. And I think it says a lot about a student who ignores the rests that are written in music. And for every note value that we have written, like a quarter note, a half note, a whole note, an eighth note, there's a corresponding rest of that same value. We have quarter rest, half rest, whole rest, eighth rest. So it's very specific. And the only answer that I can accept in good faith is that the written notes are just as important as the written rests, and vice versa. And I mean, it's part of a gateway conversation that I have, a larger conversation, that music has no value if it just happens, you know, anywhere. If it just happens, you know, there's no difference between music and the noise you hear on the street, the background noise that you hear. But if it happens at a very specific point of time and it's framed in that silence, it has the greatest meaning possible. And I think something that I've been thinking about a lot lately with this whole shutdown, and, you know, a lot of us have kind of lost our identity. You know, we've identified ourselves by our career, what we do, what our function is, what our usefulness is. And, you know, we kind of have no choice but to face this silence right now. And I mean, you were even mentioning how there's so many different ways and so many different traditions that they try to make meditation a little bit more appealing. And I mean, we even have apps that try to incentivize meditation and make it like a cool thing that you can quantify. And so I think what all this is leading to, my question is, many different schools of Buddhism, they talk about the Dharma ending age, the period that they call Mappo, where the Dharma is just going to die out and no one's going to practice anymore. And if we're this uncomfortable being silent, that we have to decorate silence, that we have to glamorize, like, you know, we're just finding new ways to fill that silence, kind of rendering everything else obsolete. What is the hope for our practice going forward when even right now people, like you said, Zen is the most boring of all meditation? You know, how will people keep practicing when no one seems to be comfortable with the silence?
Great question, Nick. And thanks for all that information about the music. It's so true. I mean, I've been actually thinking also about music and time, and how our short-term memory is really important for really processing music. Like, you can't necessarily replay a whole song in your head, but when you hear a note, it only sounds like music because of the silence and the other notes that came right before it, and how your brain integrates that together. It's just an amazing phenomenon. But back to your question. So first of all, I have tried other kinds of meditation, quote meditation. Like, I used to do yoga nidra at work when I needed a power nap, like relax your body. And I have to say that other traditions are great, that they serve some purpose and they all have their different merits and appeal to different things. But they're not Zen. They're right. It's just a completely different thing, like apples and oranges. So this is not to diss other forms of meditation or other practices, because I think that they have some benefit for people. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist. Right. They wouldn't continue. But you're right that the Zen meditation, Zazen in particular, is unique in its emphasis really on silence, stillness, minimal instruction, no praise, no blame, no nothing. In that silence, you really become in touch with your own inner wisdom. Like, you know, because you have no one telling you what to do, you start to actually listen to something. And I don't want to say just listen to yourself. It's more like, I hate this analogy, but so my first Zen teacher, Natalie, used to use this analogy, and I actually can't think of a better one, but it's like in an ocean when there's a dead fish at the bottom of the sea and it just floats to the top. I mean, you have some wisdom that comes from a deep place that's not on the surface, and it's just like from the bottom of the ocean, plop, and it comes up to the top. And there's something unique about sitting in silence that helps us access a kind of awareness that's difficult when we're chit-chatting all the time. But I would say that a lot of this busyness and go, go, go and bells and whistles and dressing up meditation. And it's not even just meditation. It's that we're bombarded with information. And a lot of that is pretty artificial, to be honest. I had an experience where I went to Cuba for a couple weeks and I was blown out. I was not expecting this, but in Cuba, it's like going backwards in time. I did not see a single advertisement, not on a billboard, not in a radio, nothing. The entire time I was there, all the cars were like old styles and stuff, but it made me realize how much we actually are bombarded with advertisements and information and news and TV and radio. And, you know, my little second cousin, who's like 5 years old, has an iPad and she's playing with it. And I was like, I didn't even have a cell phone till I was in college. And it was the kind you had to click, you know, three times to get the letter C. So a lot of this constant distraction and development even of ADD and autism, and you know, where we have a hard time paying attention and have so much information, is actually because we're in a conditioned environment. It's actually because it's kind of artificial. It's not really our natural state of being. So while we could say, okay, people lose interest or have a hard time being with silence, actually our natural state is to allow for silence. And I think we all notice this when we take a little vacation away from Silicon Valley and go sit by a river or go for a walk in the woods. I mean, people just talk about how refreshed they feel when they come back. And so I think there's something in the human spirit that wants to be close to nature, that wants to really feel and be connected with everything. And it'll come up. But I think it's going to be an ongoing struggle, because it's like the yin yang. They look like they're opposing each other, right? Like the busyness and go, go, go and do this. And this, like, no, slow down, enjoy nature, relax. And I think it's just up to all of us to listen and understand when we're in balance and when we're not in balance. Ultimately, it comes down to trusting ourselves, learning to trust ourselves rather than being told you should do this and buy this and work here and that's going to make you happy. And then you do all of that and it doesn't make you happy, you know? So ultimately comes to really trusting ourselves. And everyone is on their own journey with that one. Yeah. Did that answer your question? Kind of was a little rambling, but thank you.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Cool. Dave?
Sorry, my computer was acting up. Thank you, Bonnie. Your talk about silence and you know, the compulsion to constantly feel busy reminds me of something that I experienced early in my meditation practice many years ago. It's not exactly the same, but it feels like it's closely related. I remember sitting one morning and this voice in my head said, you know, this Zazen stuff really isn't getting you anywhere. It's really not accomplishing anything. And immediately the other little voice in my head said, yeah, isn't it great?
Yeah, that's awesome.
I think we just get so intoxicated with the need to feel like we're busy, busy, busy. We're accomplishing something. We're getting somewhere. And in a way, we're sort of conditioned to be terrified of sitting silently and experiencing who we really are.
Mm.
And, you know, that's really what we get out of Zazen. It doesn't get us anywhere. It lets us understand where we really are in the first place.
Mm.
Anyway, that's, you know, I don't know what you feel about that, but that's sort of somehow what you said sort of resonated with that experience that I had many years ago.
Yeah, that was beautiful. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, I think we've been conditioned to believe that our self-worth and value comes from, you know, our job title, our resume, and actually focusing too much on that can actually separate us from other people and make us more miserable. So, yeah. Just Zazen doesn't get us anywhere. It lets us know where we are already. Yeah, that's very true. Well said. And another thought that occurred to me, kind of after what Nick said, is, a lot of people are in different places with their relationship to boredom right now, because some people have lost their jobs and they feel useless because they've been conditioned to think that that was their identity. And other people are still having to do their jobs, but it's just harder with all of the things they have to do because of the situation. So they're actually working harder and longer, and they're not bored at all. And people also have different relationships with being at home with their family, and some people love it and other people just can't wait to get their kids back in school and get a break from them. So it's interesting how it's affecting a lot of people differently. And some people are really looking for things to do, and other people are really looking for rest, and we're just all kind of in different places trying to figure it out together. Kind of in a collective forced retreat, whether you wanted to sign up or not. Yeah. Mahesh.
Thank you, Bonnie, for your talk. So I think a lot of what we do, right, like it is driven by, like we want to accomplish something, maybe like in life, right, like we want to, there is some kind of the stress also that is created by partly due to the mind chatter that happens, the commentary or whatever that happens on what is happening, and also like partly due to like all of these other things, like wanting to fulfill our potential. There is also this comparison, greed, or comparing with others, and then like mm-hmm. these kinds of things, right? I think these are the things that prevent us from, let's say, going back to our grandma's house or like that kind of a situation, right? So given this, given that you have this information of now you, right, like what would you, like, let's say, given a second chance, my question is like, given a second chance, how would you lead your life? How would it be different from what it is now? Assuming like, let's say, financial thing is not a problem, right? Just to take out the practical equation, just a hypothetical question.
Thank you, Mahesh. Yeah, it's a tough question, because you say, oh, just forget about the financial part, but that's a big part, right? It is a big part for people, unless you were, inherited a ton of wealth from a millionaire family. It's interesting, because I went into engineering, not for the money in particular. Actually, I was actually really interested in it. So I'm glad I studied something I actually had genuine interest in. But, too much of a good thing is not a good thing anymore. And I think if I could go back and do things, I would listen to myself more. I would, I would follow my intuition more, for lack of a better word for it. I've learned to listen more to my intuition in these days. And usually when I do, it works out better and I'm happier with the result, whatever it is, relationship, family, finance, anything. And when I don't listen to it, and the inner voice is telling me something, it's usually causes me suffering. I think when I was younger, it's hard because you don't know what you don't know, So if I could go back and do things, I'd be going back with the wisdom that I have now, which I couldn't have learned without going through a bunch of, difficult experiences. But when I was young, you really could not express a lot of emotion. There was not really much space for that, for talking about feelings and things. You kind of had to just do good and follow the rules and stay in school and don't question things. And I ended up really excelling in some things and really being deficient in other things. So I always did really well in school, really well at work. And yet I always had pretty difficult and complicated relationships. And I suffered from depression for many years, starting in adolescence. At 16, I was hospitalized for depression. That's how bad it was. And through my early 20s. And I actually completely cured myself of depression. I'm someone who was diagnosed with major depression for a number of years and have no trace of it anymore. And I wish I could say, oh, it was a quick fix. You just do this. Well, it was a whole lifestyle change. I had to change the way I ate, the way I took care of my body, the way I approached relationships, the way I had a hard time saying no to people. I say no much more easily to people now, and sometimes they don't like it, but I have to because it makes my life more balanced, you know? So I had a lot of strengths when I was young. Like I said, I excelled in school and I felt really good in some areas of my life, but there were other areas that were very neglected and it wasn't balanced. So I think that doing aspect of go, do, achieve, it's not inherently bad. There's a place where that is appropriate, but that's not all there is. So I wish that someone had told me when I was younger, that's not all there is. You know, and there were a few glimpses of that. Actually, I remember when my great grandma died and in the hospital and I could see her there, her dead body. And I was next to my grandmother, who was still alive. And she looked at me and she said, "It's okay to cry." And that was the only time anyone ever told me that. You know, my parents were, they never showed emotion, never talked about feelings. But my grandma said, "It's okay. If you can cry, it's all right." And, you know, having space for that softer side helped to balance things out over time. And I think often we're taught, don't listen to your feelings, you know, operate by logic. But sometimes that gut feeling knows way before your brain does. And your brain will catch up later as to why your gut feeling was right about something. And so I wish I had known about that earlier, but I know now. So I'm better at listening to that gut feeling.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any last questions before we close for the evening?
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.